Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's been an interesting day. I had occasion to go over to Cella Vista Mall, which is where the Walmart is, where the shooting took place. And the street's blocked off that runs behind it, and it's been turned into a memorial for those people who were shot, guarded by police officers. I'm a little puzzled. In reading all the write-ups on all the folks who were killed in all the shootings, I was interesting to note that everyone was described as a literal saint. Not sure why. Interesting, though. Well, we are going to talk about more creatures of the night. Because there's a lot out there that you don't routinely hear about. And it's not just here. It's all over the world. You know, from various parts of South America, for example, including Colombia, Ecuador, and Venezuela, there are stories of a massive, mighty, and extremely violent Bigfoot known as Mano Grande. Now, I spent, 3 years down there when I was working for Uncle Sam. I didn't hear those stories. One of the most fascinating but also disturbing and tragic stories came from Count Pino Tirola, an archaeologist who traveled the world, Indiana Jones style, you know, in pursuit of all things bizarre. He died in 1984 at the early age of 62. He was born in Yugoslavia, immigrated to Canada, developed what became known as the Tirola controlled descent parachute that was used by the U.S. military. Now that I've heard of. While traveling across South America in the 60s, he first heard about the marauding monster. Got the information from his guide, Antonio, who told a very interesting story. Apparently, some years before that, Antonio and his two sons traveled to a particular range in Venezuela where they were confronted on the sprawling savanna by a trio of enormous gorilla-like animals at about 8 feet in height, had long hanging arms and tiny heads. Not only that, they were armed with large and crudely fashioned wooden clubs. A violent altercation broke out, which resulted in one of Antonio's sons being beaten to death by these creatures. We didn't have time to investigate the matter of the Mono Grande at the time, but 6 months later, he's back. And this time, it wasn't ancient historical artifacts he was looking for. It was for the South American Bigfoot itself. Hooked up with Antonio again, and they, along with three other native men, headed off to where Antonio's son had been beaten to death. And later, Tirolo told a fascinating story. He said, when we set out from the camp, we began hiking southeast across the savannah, and after a few hours entered the forest. We followed a narrow track through undergrowth so thick that it reduced our vision to only a few feet on either side. Only now and then did a clearing enable us to have a field of view of 6 to 10 meters ahead. Now, for those who've never been in real jungle, it can be so thick that somebody standing 5 feet away from you can't be seen. And the what's called the canopy, the trees above you, can be so thick you can't see the sky. He said, when we entered the canyon, where Antonio had seen the big mono, the Indians became very alert and apprehensive. They stepped carefully and sensing every sound and movement in the brush around them. Tirolo was carrying a 3.5 Winchester automatic and kept it ready. Tension was mounting as they slowly made their way along the trail. And a subdued light created lurking shadows and a mood of mystery. Now, it was getting toward late afternoon when suddenly they heard a howl, very loud, coming from somewhere in the thick vegetation. The Indians froze. The howl was as loud as the roar of a jaguar, but it was higher and shriller in pitch. It reverberated through the forest. It seemed to come from all directions. Something was moving, crashing through the underbrush. The Indians turned abruptly and raced back along the trail, yelling at Tirolo to follow him. But he was frozen in his tracks, his heart beating so hard he could hear it. And suddenly the howling stopped. He said, I waited, and when I regained control of my movements, I advanced slowly along the trail, my finger on the trigger of the gun. When I reached a small clearing, the howling started again, and one crescendo after another. But again, as suddenly as it started, it stopped. He said, and it was then I saw two furry patches running away from me with a leaping sort of step through the foliage that bordered the clearing. And as they bounded across the surface of a group of boulders at the far end of the clearing, he said, as I came from Grimstone, they were clearly erect, hairy, ape-like creatures and appeared to be over 5 feet tall. And then they disappeared around the rocks into the jungle. He said, I heard the cracking sounds of dry twigs and branches as they hastily forged their way through the thick underbrush. He said, I waited for what seemed an eternity for something else to happen, trying to just get his mind around what he just glimpsed. Opened his mouth to call out to his companions, but no sound came out. Finally, he turned and retraced his steps and encountered them advancing cautiously back up the trail. He said, they're gone. Nobody uttered a word. They continued up the trail. They didn't see any sign of them or hear anything of them again. Now, for those who have no experience in the jungle, there's a lot of creatures there that you don't hear a lot about. I had experiences with something called a hollow monkey. Now, you've seen, if you ever saw a Tarzan film, Cheetah, who's a chimpanzee, of course, they show gorillas. But a hollow monkey stands between 3 or 4 feet tall. They're very territorial. And if you enter their territory, they will defecate in their hand and throw it at you. So when we patrolled through the jungle, you never wanted to be on point or at the rear, because you would come back looking and smelling totally different. And they also were fascinated by shiny things, and they would imitate what they would see. we had we were bivouacked one night in the jungle. We had APCs, armored personnel carriers. And if you open the troop hatch, which was on top, the top rear, you could get enough of a breeze to make it livable. So quite often at night, if we were out in the jungle, we would sleep in the APC. And a number of us had military watches that glowed in the dark. And I was making the rounds of my unit one night when I heard all hell break loose from where I knew one of my APCs was parked. So when I went over there, I saw all my troops scattered through the jungle, and I watched the APC drive off. Now, I knew there were nine men on board that particular APC, and I had nine men out there in the jungle, so who was stealing the APC? Well, when I restored order, they said something dropped through the troop hatch from the tree above them, because apparently whatever it was, and we discovered later was a hollow monkey, had seen the face of one of the watches glowing in the dark and wanted it. So he dropped through the hatch to grab it, scared the crap out of everybody on board, so they, of course, abandoned ship. And since they'd had it running for, we'd start them up periodically during the night, because sometimes the moisture of the jungle would cause problems. You'd have trouble starting them in the morning. So during the night, periodically, it would start it. And if you've ever been inside an APC, instead of an accelerator and a steering wheel, you've got two large, or at least on those, two large levers. And the driver had been going to move it because they discovered up in the tree above them was a hornet's nest about 6 feet tall and about 4 feet around. And they were just going to move slightly so if it fell during the night, and usually they didn't, but better to be safe than sorry. So as the guy is moving the APC, the creature drops through the troop hatch, and everybody abandons ship, to include the driver, because right above the driver there's a hatch. Well, he didn't stop the APC before he abandoned ship. So the APC and the hollow monkey are rolling through the jungle. And we had set up our bivouac on the edge of a... in the jungle south of the Panama Canal Zone, a lot of it was up and down. It wasn't flat. And there was something of a drop-off about 6 feet in front of where the APCs were parked. So I got to the edge in time to see the APC heading south. And well, I could never got that thing out of that ravine. Eventually we did. I'm happy to report the hollow monkey escaped unharmed, apparently. But it was, that night was quite interesting. I had nine terrified soldiers, because a lot of our troops were of, actually were born in South America, and they grew up with all the superstitions. Now, while you may be educated enough to know there's nothing to it, it's hard to disregard all the stories you hear growing up. So it was interesting. Then we had another situation involving the hollow monkeys. We were sent to a place called A.O. Mosquito. I put this story on my YouTube channel. I call it the monkey with the machine gun. And A.O. Mosquito was an isolated area surrounded by the water on three sides. We were brought in by helicopter. And we broke up into different units. And we had a brand new lieutenant in charge of one of the platoons. That was Haywood Mills. His father was a congressman, so of course he thought he was kind of God's gift to the world. Nobody else did, but he did. So he and his unit were out there in the jungle, and he was going to prove what a great military leader he was. And he decided he was going to ambush my unit. Well, we were operating independently because the 82nd was going to be dropping in on us the next day, and this was going to be an aggression against them. And Mills was not one of my favorite people anyway. So, when it started getting dark, according to the map, we're about a mile from a river that ran through the training area. And there was only one way to get across the river, and that was a narrow bridge. Well, Mills and his happy band of men set up an ambush on the bridge. But it started getting dark, and I didn't want to mess with it. So we went up on some high ground about a mile from the bridge and set up camp. And while the jungle can be a royal pain in the rear, when the weather conditions are right and it's dark and the breezes are blowing from the sea, it is absolutely a tropical paradise until the mosquitoes show up. And some of those are as big as birds. So anyway, we're set up, and I had a hammock that my parents had sent me. So I set up the hammock, and I was laying back enjoying the breeze. And I hear all hell break loose. I mean, there was no doubt in my mind there was a serious firefight going on down around that bridge. So I radioed in, and nobody knew anything about anything. Because all the units are in radio contact with battalion headquarters, which was on the west side of the isthmus. And we were on the east side in the training area. And then I heard some garbled communications because I was getting bleed over from another frequency. And what I didn't know is Mills had sprung his ambush in what he thought was my unit. And what it was, unbeknownst to us, farmers had moved into the area. And every farmer had I guess it was mandatory, I don't know who was issuing them, but every farmer had a cow. And on this night, this particular farmer was taking his cow down to the river, and he's walking along the trail that we would have walked on had we been going that way. And Mills and his people sprang their ambush on the farmer and the cow. Now, if you've never heard the blanks in an M16, they sound just like the real thing. And, of course, you got parachute flares and all this other stuff. Well, the old farmer and the old cow were both so scared they keeled over. Both of them. And they radioed back to the colonel that they had incurred some casualties. So I was one of the senior officers around. So the colonel radioed me. Go deal with it. So we went down to the bridge, and there's this farmer laid out, and there's a cow laying on his back with all 4 feet in the air. And we radioed for a medevac, picked up the farmer, and put the cow in a sling underneath and took both of them in the battalion headquarters. Well, Lieutenant Mills was not exactly coherent because he was sure he was going to be held responsible for murdering the farmer and the cow. And Sergeant Harris, who was his platoon sergeant, was just, when I got there, he was trying to give mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to the cow. I didn't know you could do such a thing. So I calmed everybody down and told them to go on up on the other side of the river, and there was a campground up there, and just set up, and we'd come check on them in the morning. And we went back up on the hill and went back to bed. Well, about 2 hours later, all hell broke loose again. And while I was with them, I'd found out the frequency they were operating on, so I'd have radio communication with them. Because I told them I'd find out the status of the farmer and the cow and let them know. So I radioed to that unit, and it took forever for anybody to answer. It was Sergeant Harris, and I said, well, what's going on? And he said, oh, nothing, it's just a mistake, misunderstanding. Don't worry about it. I said, well, let me talk to the lieutenant. No, he's busy. You can't talk to him. Now, one of the main jobs of a platoon sergeant is to take care of his lieutenant. That means if the lieutenant's going to put both feet in his mouth, you don't let him get on the radio. And I realized this, and my own platoon sergeant was tugging on my sleeve saying, don't ask. So we went back to bed again. And about an hour later, a third firefight broke out. And I didn't even bother calling. We just sat on the hill and watched all the pyrotechnics of the parachute flares going up and all this. Well, about 2:30 in the morning, I get a radio call from the colonel himself. Now, this colonel did not make radio calls himself. That's what he had a staff for. So for him to call me directly meant there was something going on I didn't want to be involved in. But unfortunately, I didn't have an excuse to not answer. And I responded. He said, I want you to go to the campsite of the other unit and help them find the lieutenant. I said, say what? They've lost their lieutenant. You get over there and handle it. Well, that's military speak for get over there, take charge, and you're going to get the blame when this goes south. So we folded up our camp, and nobody was happy about this. So it's just, by the time everything gets straightened out and we're on the way over there, it's just starting to be enough light you could see your hand in front of your face. I guess it was maybe pushing 5 in the morning. So I get to the campsite, and it looks like Beirut. There's burned tents. The underbrush is still smoldering. There's some kind of concoction laying across the main campfire. And everybody looks like they've been through the wars. So Sergeant Harris is sitting on a downed tree. So I go over and sit down beside him, and I just look at him, and he says, "In my 17 years in the Army, I've never had anything like this happen." So sometimes you got to let people just talk it out. He said, "We got here, we got set up, and since we didn't know when the 82nd was coming, we had to post guards." And as I said earlier, about half our folks were of Panamanian extraction. That seemed to be everybody's goal, you know, join the U.S. military. And they're highly superstitious in many cases. And one of the guys had an M60 machine gun. And he was kind of John Wayne-ing. He had it balanced on his hip and it was just strolling around the camp area. And it had on its end what's called a blank adapter. There's got to be a gas feedback for the bolt to work so the weapon will fire more than once at a time. And that blank adapter is kind of a sparkly red. And that's so that you can tell there's a blank adapter on the weapon from a distance. Well, in the firelight, it glittered. So he's walking around, and this big hairy hand comes down from the tree he walks under and grabs the end of the barrel. He lets them have the weapon and takes off running and screaming, and he runs right through the middle of the camp. The lieutenant, who had one of these fancy mosquito net air mattress deals that you got at the Army surplus store in the land of the big PX, as we used to call the states, jumps up, forgets he's under a mosquito net, panics, grabs his own weapon and starts firing. Which, of course, caused all kinds of chaos and confusion. And then, walking into the camp, balancing that M60 on his hip, is one of the biggest hollow monkeys anybody had ever seen. And when the lieutenant starts shooting, the hollow monkey gets scared. And, of course, when you get scared, your muscles tighten. He fired the M60 machine gun. It had a 200-round... It didn't have a magazine. On the side of it was a place where you hung a box containing the linked rounds. 200 rounds. And the monkey doesn't know to let go of the trigger. And when you balance it on your hip, the natural place to grab it is at the trigger. So he starts firing the machine gun. The troops panic and start shooting. They don't know who they're shooting at, but by God, they're shooting. And then they, for illumination, start firing parachute flares. Well, the monkey literally has a heart attack and collapses. The lieutenant was so scared he had an accident. And according to Harris, he stunk so bad, they made him bury his uniform. So now we got tall, skinny Hayward Mills, naked as a jaybird, in the jungle. Those of us who've been around a while always had a spare uniform in our rucksack. He didn't bring one. Well, Harris got order restored. And the reason he didn't want to let me talk to Mills when I radioed in was that Mills was in a state. So having destroyed his mosquito net and trying not to be eaten by mosquitoes, Mills pulled his air mattress, which hadn't been damaged, close to the fire. Because there's things you can find in the jungle, and a lot of my troops knew about them, that you could throw on the fire and the smoke would keep the mosquitoes away. At least around the fire. So Harry said everything was fine for a couple of hours, and something woke him up, and he looked over toward Mills, and he said it looked like the lieutenant was pregnant. He had this big bump on his lower chest. Well, that big bump was the head of a 17-foot-long boa constrictor that had crawled into the camp. Now, it gets damn cold in the jungle at night. And snakes, being cold-blooded to begin with, find a place where they can curl up. But in this particular case, the fire and the heat it gave off drew the snake. And you may think 17 feet is unusually long, but we've had situations where we ran over snakes so big, the head was the bushes on one side of the road and the tails in the bushes on the other side, and the road was about 15, 16 feet wide. So Mills woke up, glances down, sees the snake, and literally levitates off of his air mattress, hits the ground, running and screaming into the jungle, which scared the crap out of his troops, and they all started shooting again. So when I get there, I see what looks like a body laying in the edge of the encampment. The place is a total shambles, and Harris looks like he's ready to have a stroke. And he said he had everything under control, except they could not find the lieutenant. Now, there's not too many places a naked lieutenant can go in the jungle, especially in a place like Ao Mosquito, which is on the backside of nowhere. So we started sweeping the jungle looking for a naked lieutenant, and we couldn't find him. We looked most of the morning. And finally, we're standing on the beach, wondering where to search next, when I happen to glance out toward the ocean, and I see a head just above the water. Well, there's a sandbar about 100 yards offshore. And Mills had been so scared by the snake, he was sitting on the sandbar and wouldn't come in. I had to have two guys strip and go out and bring him in. And then we had to have him medevac out so that they could kind of get him under control. I mean, you know, congressman's son and all this. But that was one of the most unusual operations. And hollow monkeys, if you get one cornered, can be downright vicious. So something like the Mono Grande, which seems to come from the same general area, is certainly a possibility there. But you might go to my YouTube channel and look at the monkey with the machine gun, because that's pretty much what happened. Now, there's a lot of folks who style themselves as monster hunters. One of them is Neil Arnold. And he told a story that when he first began writing for Animals and Men magazine, he mentioned Animals and Men magazine is put out by the Center for Fortean Zoology. He mentioned to John Down something regarding cryptozoological pub signs. Now, there are a lot of St. George and the Dragon signs, and there's a few that talk about unicorns. But there's one particular pub, belongs to the Wild Man at 29 Bedford Street in Norwich, England. Now, most pub signs have some kind of meaning. But the legend behind the Wild Man sound is somewhat intriguing. According to the folklore, many, many years ago, a six-year-old boy named Peter became lost in a wood in Germany. About 6 years later, the boy had grown wild and was in naked form, would prowl the woods, living alongside the resident animals. And eventually he was found and picked up by a traveling showman who exhibited him throughout Europe. And St. Mary's North Church adds more to the legend because within its walls there's an inscription that reads, "To the memory of Peter, known as the Wild Boy, who'd been found wild in the forest of Hirschwald near Hanover in the year 1725. He appeared to be about 12 years old. The following year he was brought to England by the order of the late Queen Caroline and the ablest masters who provided for him. But proving himself incapable of speaking or of receiving any instruction, comfortable provisions made for him at a farm in the parish where he continued to the end of his inoffensive life. He died 22nd of February 1785, about 72 years old. But you have to ask yourself why there was an association between Wild Peter and the Norwich Space Pub itself that led the owner to even name it the inn after this unfortunate individual. Well, according to Neil, about 1751, Peter was housed at the public house. And in the past, the sign would depict the unfortunate chap as a demonic character amid flickering flames. And now the pub sign shows him frequenting the forest alongside bears. And as far as the British Isles are concerned, Richard Holland, the author of Haunted Wales, A Survey of Welsh Ghost Lore, offers his own particular thoughts on the nature of the legendary beast under scrutiny. It's been suggested that the wood woes is a folk memory of some species of early hominid, a pre-Homo sapien ape man, I guess you could say. Perhaps a few remnants of these wild men still linger in the inaccessible places where a prehistoric man first hacked their way through Europe's primeval forest. In fact, they might have been glimpsed by the Neolithic settlers in the hearts of what remained of their woodland habitat. In Sproutton in Suffolk, according to John Mitchell and Bob Rickard, the Wild Man Inn was so named after a terrifying entity that attacked its builders in the 16th century. They also cite a police report of a horrible, uncouth creature which had been living in woods near the Salisbury in Wiltshire and attempted to carry off a farmer's wife, recorded as late as 1877. And there are witnesses today who may have encountered a similar man-beast in northeast Wales. Now, Wales is some of the wildest animals you'll find. Although some of the stories of the wild man of Sproutton portray him as having been nothing more mysterious than a mad homeless vagrant who dwelled in the woods and lived a distinctly lawless life, there is a possibility he may have been something else entirely. On the north side of the River Gipping, which runs from Stowmarket to Ipswich, is a place that just happened to be called, and has been called for as long as anybody remembers, Devil's Wood, where significant archaeological finds from both Neolithic and Paleolithic times have been made. Sproutton is only 12 miles from Stowmarket and just 3.5 miles from Ipswich. An ancient man dwelled in this very area, and that the place itself became associated with the devil collectively suggests a distinct possibility the wild man of Sproutton may have been far more than an eccentric vagabond or a hermit. Maybe, incredibly, is one of the very last of his kind, maybe even a Neolithic survivor, one who's made his lair in old woods that, not surprisingly, given the man's wild appearance and mysterious presence, became so linked with matters so dark and devilish that it forever was known as Devil's Wood. You know, if the Coleus Camp, which was caught in 1939 from a fishing trawler, which is supposed to have been extinct for 65 million years, still survived, there's no telling what else may be out there. You know, in the Mato Grosso in Brazil, there's a plateau that actually gave rise to Arthur Conan Doyle's Lost World story, supposedly inhabited by dinosaurs. Well, when I was in college, which was many moons ago, It was an archaeological expedition that was doing some digging in an area near there, and they found the bones of prehistoric animals that, by their reckoning, had been dead less than 10 years. I'm not sure how most folks would react if a, let's say, a Tyrannosaurus Rex came wandering down Fifth Avenue. But let's talk about Montauk. They have their own Sasquatch. One of the truly strangest, many have said wholly outrageous, allegations been made within conspiracy-themed research circles is that a relatively innocuous-looking location on Long Island, New York, originally called Camp Hero, it was a World War I military base, and later renamed to Montauk Air Force Station, which where they conducted highly classified research, has for decades been undertaken into a dizzying array of far-out issues, including time travel, teleportation, invisibility, mind control, and much more, including the creation of Bigfoot-style creatures. Now, for those who are not familiar with remote viewing, which is the use of psychics to try to gather intelligence, they give them a military map and a six-digit grid coordinate, and if you know how to use it, it's accurate to within about 10 feet. And they'll ask them to describe what's at that location. Now, some of them, surprisingly enough, have been extremely accurate. And Montauk has been an area where supposedly a lot of this research took place. There's supposed to be, underneath the base, tunnels and caverns where research goes on to this day. Now, we're not talking about genetic experiments. Now, the claim is that top secret research is a foot deep below the old base to create the Topo-style versions of Bigfoot. That is to say, monsters conjured up in the imagination, which can be then projected outwardly and given some degree of quasi-independent life in the real world. Can you imagine dropping one of those in the middle of a Russian compound? Definitely would cause some chaos and confusion. Now, Weird U.S. notes that on one occasion, one of those attached to the secret experiments, a man named Duncan Cameron, envisioned in his mind a large, angry, powerful Sasquatch-like entity that materialized at Montauk, I mean, then destroying the base. It really decimated the place, tanking the project and disconnecting it from the past. As soon as the equipment harnessing people's psychic powers was destroyed, the beast vanished. Now, if I was a Sasquatch and somebody jerked me from where I'm used to place I didn't know nothing about, I'd probably be a little annoyed as well. Now, Bernard Hevelman's one of the most important figures in the field of cryptozoology, said in the course of his research into the Yeti of the Himalayas, he had learned to know fewer than three distinct kinds of creatures that roam that vast mountain. And he said his opinion was confirmed in 1957 by a Tibetan Lama called Punyabhadra, high priest in a monastery at Budnath, who spent 4 months in the high mountains and brought back the surprising but valuable information that Tibetan mountain people knew three kinds of snowmen. There's the Rimi, a man-beast of close to 3 meters in height that dwelled in the Barunkola Valley in eastern Nepal and was specifically omnivorous. Then there's the Rakshi Bumpo, a beast of roughly human proportions that Hevelman said must be the serpent's reddest Mite, which leaves the footprints 20 to 23 centimeters long that the Daily Mail expedition found. And then there's the opposing and terrifying the Yamo. Helman's quite specific. The Yamo, he said, are real giants between 4 and 5 meters high with enormous conical heads. He said they wander in parties among the eternal snows above 4,000 meters. Now, if a meter is, I think, 39 inches, a little over 3 feet, you run into one of these creatures, you're talking 12 to 15 feet high. In such empty country, it's hardly surprising they should be carnivorous and, frankly, even man-eating. Now, of the Nyamo, everyone's asked, do they really exist or are they just a myth? Now, he had admitted to having heard of accounts of Yeti with feet around 45 to 60 meters in length, but was careful to qualify this by stating the evidence is far too slender for us to draw any satisfactory conclusions. Probably the Nyamo was an invented addition based on the belief that Yetis increase in size the higher you go. According to Lorraine Coleman, when Sir Edmund Hillary went to the Himalayas to look for the Yeti, he and his collaborator, journalist Desmond Doig, noted there were several unknown primates said to still be undiscovered in any formal way. And among the varieties was one called the Nyamo. They learned of the Nyamo in north central Nepal, and it's said to be giant sized, up to 20 feet tall, man like, hairy, and given to shaking giant pine trees in trials of strength where other Nyamo sit around and clap their hands. The matter of the curious behavior of the Nyamo, to which Coleman refers, was most graphically told by one Jean Marquet Riviera. 1937, at the details of Marquet Riviera's account first surfaced, it was picked up on by Bernard Hevelmans. According to the witness, he had occasion to speak with an Indian pilgrim who had personally encountered a group of Nyamo in the wilds of Nepal. Crypto Journal describes the extraordinary encounter in a fashion that suggests the beast have a high degree of intelligence and may even have some form of spiritual belief system. The creatures were standing as they formed a circle and were chanting as if they were doing a religious ritual or something of that sort. And one of these Yeti-like creatures was enthusiastically beating a hollow trunk of a tree like a man hitting his drums to create some music. The others continued with their chants, but their faces seemed to be filled with a sad expression. At this sight, the adventurers thought that the creatures acted like typical persons and that they shouldn't be feared. But eventually, fear set in due to the creature's massive build as they decided to walk away stealthily to avoid any sort of conflict. What may very well have been a description of the huge and reportedly extremely dangerous and violent Nyamo came from Charles Stornor, a former assistant curator of the London Zoo in England, who embarked on a quest for the truth of the Yeti in December 1953. The expedition was organized and funded by the British Daily Mail newspaper. While in Darjeeling, Stoner was told of a creature known as the Throwamung that, with hindsight, may well have been the Nyamo. According to the story that Stoner brought back, he said, long ago there was a beast in our mountains known to our forefathers as the Throwamung, meaning in our language, mountain savage. Its cunning and ferocity was so great as to be a match for anyone who encountered it. Could always outwit our lepcha hunters with their bows and arrows. These creatures are always said to have lived alone with very few of its kind, and they went sometimes on the ground and sometimes in the trees. It was found only in the higher mountains of our country, and although it was made very like a man, it was covered with long, dark hair and was more intelligent than a monkey, as well as being a whole lot larger. It seems that to a significant degree, the beasts were fighting for their very survival. The people became more in number, the forest and wild country less, and the Throwamung disappeared. But many people say they're still to be found in the mountains in Nepal, way to the west, where the Sherpa people call them the Yeti. And certainly that well may be true. As civilization expands, their areas where they live shrink. So they move further and further into the wilds. Now consider, as just one example, what actually amounts to far more than a few. The following account from the single named Ralph, a monk and an abbot of Coggeshall, Essex, England. This was written back in the year 1200 in Chronicon Anglicanum. The story describes a remarkable capture in the area of nothing less than a definitive wild man of the woods. In the time of King Henry II, when Bartholomew de Glanville was in charge of the castle at Orford, it happened that some fishermen fishing in the sea there caught in their nets a wild man. He was naked and was like a man in all his members and covered with hair and with a long, shaggy beard. eagerly ate what was brought to him, but if it was raw, he pressed it between his hands till all the juice was expelled. Ralph went on to say, wouldn't talk, even when tortured and hung up by his feet. Brought into church, he showed no signs of reverence or belief. He sought his bed at sunset and always remained there till sunrise. He was allowed to go into the sea, strongly guarded with 3 lines of nets, but he dived under the nets and came up again and again. Eventually, he came back of his own free will, but later on he escaped and was never seen again. Or maybe the Beast Man, or one of its offsprings, was seen again, although hundreds of years further down the line. Some point during the summer of 1968, one Morris Allen, who grew up in the vicinity of Orford, was walking along the coast near, of all places, the town of Orford itself, when in a distance he saw somebody squatting on the sand, leaning over something. As he got closer, he said, he could see the man was dressed in what looked like an animal skin, was savagely tearing into the flesh of a dead rabbit. The man was dirt encrusted with long, tangled hair and had wild, staring eyes. Morris could only watch with a mixture of fascination and horror. Suddenly, the man held his head up, looked around, or frankly, glared was a better description, in Morris's direction as if he picked up the scent. Scooped up the rabbit, bounded off into the grass, and was gone. Well, for a highly traumatized Morris Allen, it was an event destined not to be forgotten. Maybe the wild man of Orford and its surrounding area continues to live on, taunting and tantalizing people with the occasional sighting of its bestial form. But it can be said with a high degree of accuracy, and there's far more to Orford than just its infamous lighthouse. And from England, we go to Puerto Rico. What's now more than a few occasions, Puerto Rico is reveal stories of mystery, most of which have had at least some sort of connection to the controversy surrounding the island's resident blood-sucking nightmare, the famed Chupacabra. Indeed, when it comes to the matter of strange creatures roaming around the many wilds and forested areas of Puerto Rico, it's the Chupacabra that automatically comes to mind. Well, it's a little-known fact, though, that the Chupacabra is not the only weird beast rumored to haunt the island of Puerto Rico. Well, certainly not on every occasion, but on at least 2 occasions, there have been reports of encounters with what can only be described as Bigfoot-style creatures, as amazing as it may sound. Without doubt, the most fascinating body of data on the curious issue surfaced in August of 2013. Well, a lot of people go looking for the Chupacabra, as it was originally known, the goat sucker, but ended up on the receiving end of a varied body of Bigfoot-themed material. There's something about the Puerto Rican Bigfoot that, well, just doesn't jive. Those cryptozoologists believe the Bigfoot in North America, Australia's Yowie, and the Yeren of China, and the Himalayan Yeti are nothing more than unknown animals of a flesh-and-blood nature. One of the people that was interviewed was a ghost hunter and paranormal investigator named Peter. Originally from Berlin, Germany, he moved to Puerto Rico to live in 1996. Peter's accounts of Bigfoot activity in Puerto Rico were as fascinating as they were controversial. They had less to do with what one might call unknown animals and more to do with what might justify them to be called downright paranormal anomalies. Now, it's important at the outset to stress that Peter was not somebody whose files on Bigfoot were overflowing. In fact, it was quite the opposite. A number of the reports in his archives are less than 20 and span from 70s to 98, with a spate of reports in 85. That is to say, they were large humanoid covered in dark hair and solitary. Well, while most of the reports came from the island's huge El Yunque rainforest, 2 were rather incredibly reported from the fringes of Puerto Rico's capital city of San Juan. But as is always the case, so many reports of Bigfoot-type creatures that come out of the British Isles, Peter's Puerto Rican reports are filled with anomalies. The Bigfoot seen in Puerto Rico in conjunction with these were seen in conjunction with anomalous lights in the skies, although not specifically called UFOs. And I might point out, in the States, a number of Bigfoot sightings have been in the same areas where unexplained UFOs have been seen. Now, in conjunction means both time-wise and location-wise. There are also reports of the creature seemingly being impervious to bullets, which is often a reported aspect of the North American cases. Certainly the most controversial cases of all were of the creature seemingly vanishing into nothing. There was a here one minute and gone the next angle of the Bigfoot mystery that's not been discussed a great deal in the States. It's incredibly difficult to know what to make of the Puerto Rican Bigfoot. Top of that, even those reports that he shared were, for the most part, a significant number of years old, none extended beyond the 1990s. But the lack of hard data is really no reason to ignore the cases nor their intended anomalies. In fact, quite the opposite. Regardless of what the Puerto Rican Bigfoot is, and there's even a small body of material, the onus is still on us to study the mystery carefully and as thoroughly as possible. Now, no one can say for sure that Bigfoot or something like it really does lurk in the dense and wilder parts of Puerto Rico. But we can say that the witnesses most certainly believe that that is the case. Well, when the word Bigfoot's mentioned in conversation, for most people, it prompts imagery of a gigantic, bulky, 8 to 9 foot tall man monster roaming the frozen mountains and massive forests in the Pacific Northwest. And frankly, there is no shortage of such reports. It should be noted, however, that as incredible as it may sound, Bigfoot might not be the only cryptid ape that calls the United States its home. In Florida, and particularly so in the state's swampy wooded areas, there lives a beast known as the skunk ape. It's a creature whose territory also includes Arkansas and North Carolina. It's in the wilds of Florida, though, that the beast really dominates. And there's a very good reason for suggesting the skunk ape is a distinctly different creature to that reported on the West Coast. Predominantly, it's the difference in height and bulk that suggests the skunk ape and Bigfoot just might not be one and the same. Now, once again, this hour has just flown by. We've come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be talking about more creatures of the night tomorrow night, and we'll be discussing Bigfoot and skunk apes and chupacabras and almost anything and everything you can imagine. So until tomorrow night at 6 p.m., this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.